Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Caroline Miller and Ira Harris. Caroline is currently BCA's Chief Strategist, Global Strategy. Since joining BCA in 2012, she has had a cross-functional role to both contribute to and shape the global research view while communicating this message to BCA clients at an executive level. Prior to joining BCA, she spent 20 years as an institutional global fixed income asset manager. And Ira is a hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years as a floor trader. He has also served as CME director from 1997 to 2003. Welcome, Caroline and Ira.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Great. I thought we'd begin with what your current global macro themes are, Caroline, at BCA Research. If you can take us around the world and what your views are at the economy level and the financial markets level.
Sure. I'll just start by saying that we see quite a divergence in pricing. Bond markets seem to be to have a very pessimistic view of the outlook for global growth, and yet equities are close to recent highs and seem to be benefiting from low rates without interpreting the low complex of interest rates as such an omen for the outlook for the business cycle. We think that divergence will be resolved via a pickup in global growth into the end of this year. Certainly the manufacturing sector is weak and pretty ubiquitously so. It's a very vertically integrated component of the economy. But if you look at the more domestic service areas, for example, of the U.S. economy, it seems to us that U.S. growth is still ticking along at an above trend pace. And of course, the U.S. economy is a little bit less exposed to global trade than Europe and Asia. We see a lot of the weakness in global manufacturing as coming out of China, and that this trend really predates the escalation of hostility in the trade sector. It's been exacerbated by that. But really, you can trace the recent slowdown in global manufacturing to a tight policy in China from a couple years ago that has slowed fixed asset investment there deliberately, I think, to a certain extent, to control the pace of leverage growth there. But the impact has been a reduction in China's demand for resources and capital goods. That's a large part of their import activity, and that's had a knock-on effect on Japan and Europe and, most of global trade. But we see the recent easing in financial conditions and also likely stimulus from China, because, it suits them to prioritize deleveraging and containment of speculative risk when the economy is strong, but we see them pivoting to a much more reflationary policy that we expect to manifest in the second half of the year. So we see global growth stabilizing and picking up. And I think by the end of the year, the consensus outlook for global growth could look a lot brighter than it does today.
And Ira, are you seeing the similar trends from your perspective?
Well, I certainly don't look at things as in-depth as bank credit analysts, which I've been a big fan of. I actually knew Tony Beck a little bit back when I was a youngster. So I don't look at necessarily, Richard, into that, because when I don't look at the bond market as signaling a sense of global slowing, of course, because I think the bond markets are so badly distorted by central bank action that it's hard for me to know what in fact they're telling me, because of natural arbitrages that take place and the search for yield. So, I'm not, I don't dig into the data that deep to say that. I see it more from the effects of geopolitical events. I see it from Mario Draghi's Sintra speech, and then followed by 2 weeks later by Powell in his speech in Paris, with putting so much pressure on global rates, especially the long end, because people are just searching for yield wherever they can. And I'm not as sanguine about where we're going the rest of the year, and that's not because of the trade issues. I just think that geopolitical uncertainties really are increasing dramatically, and the uncertainty has led to a slowdown in capital expenditures, and it's just not because of trade. I think it's because of other things. And we'll see the way that they play out. And of course, then we get into the election year in the United States, which will be fraught with all types of, tweets and whatever type of communication is the means of the day. So all these, I think, are playing into some sense of growing uncertainties. And as David Rosenberg pointed out many times, in the Fed minutes of the June meeting, that the word risk or uncertainty appears in those 12 pages 48 times. So I think the Fed doesn't get much right of late, but that's, in my opinion. I've been of that mindset for many years already. But I think that they are right to be fearful about some of the global uncertainties, and whether or not how far they go with it, we don't know. But we'll see. So, I mean, I'm not equipped to make that type of in-depth analysis, and I respect that, because I read what you sent me from Carolyn, and I said, okay, that's fine, but I'm looking, I look at that in different ways. And again, the bond market, to me, I'd like to say that it was signaling something. I just can't figure out what it is in today's world where central banks have corrupted the market so badly.
And to what extent does your research, Caroline, factor in like central bank policies, monetary trends, monetary policy, fiscal policy, into the views that you come up with in terms of the global economy and the financial markets?
Well, I would certainly share Ira's assessment of the fact that uncertainty is a big feature of the landscape today. And I think you can see that in the global term premia that are so unprecedentedly depressed, partly as a result of central bank intervention. But, if you think about what the term premia embodies, it's a measure of expectations about inflation and the volatility of inflation and the volatility of growth. And so I think that uncertainty has driven a lot of flows into the perceived safety of high quality government bonds. I think there's no value in those markets. I think if the term premium were at a more normal level relative to history, then the yield curve would look a lot more like it has in the past. And so I would agree that the signaling mechanism from the curve isn't what it has been. But I also think that, if you think about the Fed's mandate, their mandate is to try to sustain full employment and their statutory definition of price stability for most of the time or as much of the time as possible. And since the Fed's mandate expanded in 2012, not just to include full employment, but also this inflation target, they haven't met that. They have not defended the lower bound of that 2% inflation target. And so, I think that's the reason that they are most likely tomorrow going to cut interest rates, because they are concerned about a lack of policy latitude based on the fact that interest rates are so low. I would say, though, that if it were the case that interest rates were at a distortedly low level relative to what, the supply and demand for credit, then inflation would be a lot higher. So there's some element of the low term structure of rates that is a reflection of a slower growth environment. I think it could turn out the case that, in fact, the U.S. economy is more resilient than people expect. Hindsight, we could look back on the period and say that monetary policy had been too loose for too long. I don't think that's a story for now, or really the next 6 to 12 months. That's a story for a couple of years from now. But the fact that you have coordinated central banks sort of signaling in a fairly coordinated fashion the need to support growth and aggregate demand by continuing to keep rates low is partly a response to the uncertainties coming from the political space. There's no question. But I think that people are ignoring the very high likelihood that that the Chinese economy is going to turn around as a result of a fairly reflationary policy there. And so that still leaves room for a positive growth surprise. But I do concede that geopolitical risk is elevated.
And your thoughts, Syra?
No, I just, listen, I think that's right. And the Chinese, I think, balked at doing certain things because for the last, any time we've been on the cusp of a downturn, I think the Chinese have stepped into the global void and certainly ramped up stimulus, especially credit stimulus. And I think that they're a little bit leery of where they sit right now. So they tightened, as Caroline talked about, in their own methodology last year, and it has slowed things down. And I think you're getting, there are some people who are following Trump. Look at the Japanese pushing on the South Koreans, and the South Korean numbers have turned down. The Singapore numbers are weak. So I think those will act as good indicators to whatever changes are going to be taking place when we start to see those start to shift. And right now they haven't. They still are portending and pointing to some weakness. Now, we haven't gotten to Europe yet, which is, to me, problematic in many ways. And the fact, I won't open up Europe until we're ready to, but, I don't disagree with that. I just, it's more than, of course, interest rate cuts that we're talking about here. So where we go from here will be critical. And with the Fed tomorrow, I heard an interesting discussion about an hour ago on Bloomberg Radio, where they were talking about the possibility that the Fed ends the quantitative tightening tomorrow. So you get 25 basis point cut, an end to the tightening immediately rather than waiting till September 30th, which basically gets you almost, in my estimation, then almost a 37.5 basis point cut. So Powell will be able to really thread the needle on that. But we'll see. And that's me as a trader more than doing any analysis. So I'm interested in seeing that and then see what some of the fallout is, especially the way global equity markets. And as we start to broach into Europe, I mean, today's fall in the DAX index of 2.5% was really interesting. In fact, the DAX is really weak for the month relative to fairly robust U.S. equity market. So what is that portending? And if growth in Europe continues to slow, it, of course, will put pressure on Germany for some fiscal stimulus. But again, we haven't opened up that can yet, so we will.
What are your thoughts, Caroline, on Europe, especially the interplay between what's happening in the UK and the Eurozone in terms of monetary policy, fiscal policy, and the relationships between the two?
So I continue to believe that Brexit is a European issue, but it's Britain's problem. I think that it's convenient but erroneous to attribute the weakness on the continent in terms of growth to Brexit uncertainty. I think it has a lot more to do with weak global trade. Ira cited Singapore, Japan, and Korea, exports slowing. I think a lot of that is related to China. I think you could say the same thing for Europe. But Europe's also had some idiosyncratic, domestically sourced headwinds. An important one last year certainly was the election of the populist government in Italy that caused a riot in bond markets and doubling of interest rates there. Well, that tightening in financial conditions was certainly problematic and has since really completely reversed. And if you look at some of the forward-looking data, Italian non-financial corporate credit growth on a second derivative basis, it looks like it's starting to turn around. I know that's a very early statement. I think the ECB is concerned about tighter lending standards in the euro area, and they absolutely want to see more credit flowing to the private sector. And I think you're going to see that there's a high chance that they reinitiate their asset purchase program via buying more corporate bonds. But I think if you look at France, the consumer sentiment data is improving. I would agree that overall the economy looks very weak. But again, if you start to see a pickup in China, I think that will have a knock-on effect on Europe's export sector. I think you need to see the effect of the recent drop in bond yields later in the year. And I absolutely agree that fiscal policy is the big elephant in the room. And it's interesting. I think Europe doesn't have a lot of monetary space left to ease. The rates are obviously already negative, and that's problematic for the European banks' profitability. European banks are a big part of equity market cap in Europe. But they do have a lot of fiscal space. And I think it's sort of the opposite of the U.S., where the U.S. is a high-yield market. The short rate is at 2.25%. There's room to cut, and yet fiscal policy, I think, in the States is going to turn out to be kind of maxed out. So that's how we see the policy landscape between the two. I think over the coming year, if you look at the overnight index swap market, you'll see that investors expect the ECB to ease by 22 basis points over the next 12 months and the Fed to ease by close to 90. And I think that it's going to turn out that the Fed does less than that, and Europe may ratify the market's expectations. So we see the spread between bunds and treasuries possibly narrowing over the coming year.
And your thoughts, Ira, especially with the UK as a potential repeat of what happened during the financial crisis with a weakening pound sterling currency?
Yeah, I think I'll take a different view on the Brexit. Not that its effect on Europe is what I'm worried about. I just think that the negative aspect of the way that the market has viewed the hard Brexit, it has just been wrong. And I think the weaker the pound sterling gets, the easier it is, or it's a safety valve and pressure release for the UK, because that's the advantage that Britain has. The currency will go down. We're almost at 92 on the euro sterling cross today, but in the same vein, where the German stock market really got whacked today, the FTSE's down maybe 0.5%, maybe 0.4, not much. The gilt market has held up beautifully. So if you're telling me that there's going to be an absolute financial crisis in Britain due to a hard Brexit, I'm just not seeing it in the financial instruments. And I will say that the strength in the gilt is actually genuine relative to what takes place in the European sovereign debt market, because we know that that the Bank of England has not bought any. There's been no QE for a number of years. I think they halted at $475 billion, and it's just sat there. They're not rolling it. If it rolls off, they renew it, so it just the numbers doesn't change. But it still reflects that people are buying gilts. And if I was worried about some type of really financial calamity from a hard Brexit, then who's buying these gilts? What investors are buying these gilts? And in the same vein, I can't believe that anybody would be buying any sovereign, meaning a private investor. I understand that the banks are buying, but in Europe, would you really buy a French oath for negative 15 basis points? I mean, to me, that's insanity. It's just pure insanity. And I know, I know that they go up in value because the European Central Bank ensures that they go up in value. Europe is really a difficult situation, and even more so because of, to me, what the central bank, you know, Richard, I've been on quite a bit with you. I am not a Mario Draghi fan because I don't worship the author of loose money driving asset prices. That's not the game that I play. I look at the world arena in a far different light, and I think he's been very dangerous, and it gets more and more dangerous. And it so happens today that there's actually an article that we haven't seen in a couple of years, but in today's FT by Claire Jones, the piece on the German court hears case against ECB bond buying again. And the name of the plaintiffs in the case, the number is 2,000. So there's a lot of unhappiness, and I'm not sure the way that is totally going to play out. And I'll say one more thing about Europe. Between President Macron and Angela Merkel, Donald Trump is going to make their lives miserable. And as soon as he turns from the tariffs on China, he is going to try to just stir the pot, as I would say, as he likes to do, and start directing some more conversation towards tariffs, towards Europe, which certainly will not sit well. And we'll see how they respond.
And Caroline, your thoughts on what Ira is seeing?
I'm not sure that it's going to be in Trump. I'll sort of work backwards from the last comments. I'm not sure that it's going to be in Trump's interest to expand, escalate, and proliferate this trade conflict the closer we get to the election. As we've already seen from the CEO roundtables in the States, political uncertainty around trade policy does have an impact on capital spending intentions. And the closer we get to the election, the more business sentiment, I think, becomes relevant for him. And to the extent that it's clear that interest rates are very low, and if you start to see the cyclical but very domestic sectors of the U.S. economy performing well, and the more globally exposed sectors doing poorly because of this concern about trade conflict, I don't see how that's that lines up with his incentive structure. So I think Macron has actually defeated the yellow vest movement. I was just in France and saw very clearly that roar has slowed to a whisper. There's and I think he's going to get through quite a bit of needed structural reform there. I think in Germany, ironically, the more weakness you see in Germany proper, the higher the odds that they also abandon this obsession with balanced budgets, and it increases the odds of some fiscal stimulus. As far as Brexit goes, I agree. Every day that you see the pound down, you see the relative performance of the FTSE 100, which is the large cap multinational index, which basically has very little to do with the British economy, but a lot of English domiciled firms in there outperform the FTSE 250, which is the more, which is the index with the more domestic firms in it. So there's a very clear relationship between the ebb and flow of sterling and those two indices. I think about the uncertainty related to Brexit on a continuum. I think part of that is because I grew up in Quebec, which had its own separatist movement for years that also involved two referenda that never actually, from a statutory perspective, was passed. But the drain on business sentiment, confidence, talent, and capital from the province over the last generation is very clear to see. And it has, you know, caused the center of Canada financially to shift from Montreal to Toronto. And I think the longer this issue simmers or boils in Britain without resolution, the worse it is, particularly for a country that's running a 4% current account deficit.
Just running out of time here, but the last question, you mentioned, Caroline, in your global macro and market outlook that for on Europe, that populism repudiated physical austerity more than it has stoked Euroscepticism, and Italy is prioritizing growth over deficit reduction. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So I think if you look at the polls in Europe on attitude toward EU membership, you'll see that support for the euro area as a club is actually pretty strong, and it's what most of the anti-establishment parties, the source of their support is their criticism of the parties that have heeded to the demands from Brussels for balanced budgets. So I think what you're seeing is more a rejection of fiscal austerity than you are a big statement any individual country, not talking about the UK, really thinks that their world and their citizens and their standard of living would be better outside the euro area than inside it. And if you look at Italy as an example, you know, the Lega Nord and the Five Star Movement in this coalition government, you know, they really haven't been champions of exiting the euro area. They have just stood up to the demands from the EU and Brussels that they balance their budget, and have actually, I think, won that argument. The rules around excessive deficit procedure and the fining that they could technically be subject to because they're in violation of the Maastricht Treaty haven't been invoked. And I think that's a tacit acknowledgement that a country can only service its debt, acknowledge that they have a debt burden, if they're growing. And they can't grow if the private sector is in a leveraging mode, and so, and the public sector is as well. And so I think there's, you know, slowly but surely a more permissive attitude towards some deficit spending to help support those economies. And I think, you know, that is the bigger issue than, you know, wanting to be outside the EU. It's really just a push to acknowledge that fiscal austerity is too deflationary. And I think you're going to see more of that.
Interesting. And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, I would certainly push back on that, because as Salvini looked to ramp up the deficit, he was met with threats of fines from Brussels. And I think that had a lot. He did stand up to it. Caroline's absolutely right. But the threat is there. And then, Macron will say that he would like to do that, but France is up against the limit soon. In fact, their numbers are 90% as the budget deficit as percent of GDP. So you can't get away from these. So yes, if you relinquish all those, I agree. There's two things that can make me very bullish on Europe. The creation of a harmonized fiscal authority coupled with a euro bond, which is why I think they put Lagarde in, because they're going to try to fold that entire ECB balance sheet into a euro bond, because it's already built on the capital key, which will be critical to that process. But I think we're a ways from that, and I think the Germans have not been heard from yet as to how they're going to feel about this, because again, they do have that amendment, they have the statutory law about a balanced budget. And in fact, they have been running budget surpluses, which, as Carolyn notes, gives them the flexibility to increase fiscal spending, which would help all of Europe. So I believe that Macron goes to sleep at night and prays for a recession in Europe, and not in Europe per se, but in Germany especially, that their export sector turns down and they get forced into a situation where they're going to start to expand deficit spending, which would aid all of Europe. But I just don't see it on the horizon yet. I hope I'm proven wrong, because Europe needs some reprieve from the ridiculousness that they embarked upon. But I just don't see it. And I see the Germans as getting angrier, as you can see in the weakened Merkel, which Macron is trying to take advantage of. So we'll see the way it goes.
Okay, great. Great insight and perspectives by Caroline and Ira. I guess we'll have to end it there. You have to go, Caroline, but thank you very much, both of you, Caroline
so
and Ira. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.